Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 36, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. Connecting with students on an individual level is crucial. We'll tell you what some teachers are doing to pull it off. More research says that homework may not be a necessity, and some high school journalism students published an article about the firing of a teacher, but the school deleted it. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we'll talk to a teacher that will explain how you can survive the changing fads in education. Hey, everybody. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how's it going over there? I feel like I just saw you.
Yes. In fact, I think you did just see me.
We did.
At the Mecca event, right?
Yeah. We were at a conference a few days ago, and we got a great interview that's going to be a bright idea segment in this show. Well, not this show, but the next episode. And it was with Kim Bearden. And for those who don't know, Kim Bearden is the co-founder and executive director of the Ron Clark Academy. And she has a really interesting story to tell.
Yeah. She was just a great interview all around. Like, you could tell it really wasn't her first time.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Some really good stories to go along with all her experience over there in Atlanta. But let's go ahead and we'll jump into this show. We'll get into the teacher's lounge. Lissa, why don't you tell us what you know?
Well, I have come across some really just fun teachers that are trying to connect with their kids on a certain level. Two to name, I'm sure, I feel like a lot of people have seen these videos. My mom actually sent me a video. I was like, have you seen this teacher? And I had before. But so a little shout out to Barry White Jr., fifth grade teacher at Ashley Park Elementary in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Barry White.
I'm sorry. Was everybody else thinking about Barry White?
Yes,
I was. Okay, I'm sorry.
Guys, anyway,
I'm sure he's never heard that. Okay, we'll behave.
All right, good.
We're in the teacher's lounge.
That's good.
Yeah, baby.
All right.
Okay, anyway.
That guy must have, like, the toughest
He's
life,
probably
though,
like, really? You think y'all are the first people to ever do that? But anyway, he is actually being noticed for, and news media outlets have come and videoed him. But he stands in the hallway in front of his classroom, and he has different handshakes for each child as they enter his classroom. And the child gets to come up with, you know, what they want to do. And, like, I mean, honestly, it's just so fun to watch the video because you're just like, how do they come up with that? Like, they incorporate their whole body. And what is most impressive is he remembers each student and what their thing is.
Right,
and then they enter. Yeah. And so, and there's one time, I think, I want to say Dove for Men or whatever kind of highlighted him on a national campaign. And they had a Harlem Globetrotter show up one day. He surprises students, and he was like, I can't do the handshakes today, I'm sorry. And then here comes this Harlem Globetrotter Zeus around the corner that actually took the time to also memorize every single handshake of those children and as they entered the classroom, which was, like, really cool. But there's also another teacher that does something similar, and it was actually sparked by her students, but it's the same handshake thing in the hallway. But I don't know if a child saw what the other teacher was doing on social media or something, but asked, you know, if his teacher would do it. And she does it too. I might be saying her name wrong. She's a third grade teacher, Jerusha Willenborg, at Mueller Elementary School in Wichita. But she incorporates the handshakes as they enter the classroom, but also a chant, where a lot of times, teachers will do something to call their class to attention, like a clap, 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 and the kids respond. But she has tons of things that she says and they say back.
Are you ready?
Yes, we are.
Hey.
Potato, I mean, go.
We started at the bottom.
Now all teams here.
And they're hilarious. And she'll do it throughout the day to get their attention. And you can see videos if you search her name. You can see she has a YouTube channel where She does that to connect with kids.
Give me two. Give me three.
So I think anything you can do, and she says, you know, anything to make the kids see me as a real person. Like, hey, we're all in this together. I know I used to do funny video of the day or just entertaining or enlightening video of the day. And so for homeroom, that's sometimes like a purgatorial time where you're like, yeah. You know, you've taken attendance, you're in there too long. So I would show funny video of the day, or sometimes it would just be an interesting video, like, well, like, how is peanut butter, you know, packaged? And like, it always,
how is peanut butter? We don't need to do that.
It's just a neat process to see, like, you know, there's tons of videos on YouTube. Obviously, you need to proof them ahead of time.
I'm a how it's made kind of guy. So
yes.
You're speaking my language.
Well, and I remember I showed a video once on light pollution. And, right. And so, I mean, I would do all kinds of different things just to, I don't know, just to start the day off.
I've watched a peanut butter thing before. And I
oh
know,
my gosh, yeah. Nick.
But I always thought the chunky peanut butter was they just didn't like crush the peanuts up enough.
Yeah.
But no. Like they cook the peanuts separately and put them in afterwards.
What?
Yeah. It's.
I'm a crunchy peanut butter guy.
Yeah,
I did not
too.
Know that.
Yep.
Why does that matter? It doesn't matter. It's still crunchy.
I just thought they just didn't like.
Yeah, maybe they didn't do it as much.
Right.
You know, like,
but no, it's kind of.
They didn't blend it as long.
Right. Nope. They throw them in after. They like
but
roast
they
them
still...
separately. It's like they take the smooth and then they just throw some peanuts in at the
right,
end.
Right, but they still crush some of those peanuts.
I know,
I feel
but
kind of janked, honestly. That's
yeah,
like,
but just methodology of it. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So all I'm saying is, like, I just wanted to give a shout out to some teachers that are doing something different to connect with their kids on a more personal level, because it really makes a difference. I mean, being in the same place all day long and doing the same thing over and over again can get a little monotonous and boring. And so if you do something like this to shake it up, I saw once a teacher that did songs, you know, like who's got the song of the week, you know, yep. And so kids would submit a song of the week or whatever, but then they would play it on a certain day, just a little snippet of a song.
I don't mean to keep teasing the Kim Bearden interview next week, but she talked specifically about making a connection with a student, and she told us a specific story, and she didn't do it through, you know, the handshakes, but she had to use a different method, and it makes complete sense. I mean, it's you're building trust with these students, and so maybe they're more likely to do that next assignment or follow through because they do have that respect for you.
Right, and I mean, the bottom line is, like, I could never do all the handshakes that the two teachers I mentioned do. They're fascinating to watch, but I could never do it. But I can play a funny video of the day and find those. You know, I do enjoy funny memes, you know. So I think any teacher can find something that they can connect with their kids and try to incorporate in their classroom on a daily or weekly basis to try to set up a sense of community.
Speaking of getting kids to do assignments, I know there's some new data when it comes to homework that was just released. And I think, Russ, you've been kind of parsing through that. It was in the Washington Post, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's an article that's in the Washington Post by Valerie Strauss. It came out actually a little bit some time ago. But the reason I brought it up is because in my home state of Mississippi, there is House Bill 449, an act to require public school teachers to incorporate into their curriculum daily and weekly homework assignments and for related purposes.
I didn't know that.
So every single year, this bill gets filed. And it's sort of a stupid bill. I hate to say it, not to say the person that filed it was stupid, but the concept is pretty stupid. So there's a big misnomer that homework contributes meaning in a meaningful way to a child's education. And of course, I'm sure there are some ancillary benefits. But if you look at the data, in your mind for a moment, take just a second and eliminate what you think you know about homework, right? That because you would think, kind of anecdotally, that if a child does homework at home, then therefore it's a continuation of that day's lesson, then therefore they're going to continue learning, right? What we found is that actually, or what's been found, according to this Washington Post article, is that actually isn't true. First of all, in elementary education especially, there's been no research has ever been found to find a benefit of assigning homework of any kind or any amount in elementary school. There isn't even a positive correlation of having young kids do some homework versus none or more or less or in any way affect achievement. So if we're making 10-year-olds and 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds do homework, it's really not for their benefit because it's not making a huge difference in elementary schools. Does that surprise you?
No.
It does me. I don't know. I mean, I feel like when I had to go home and drill on math equations, I got better.
I do think practice makes perfect when it comes to math, but I don't think, and I taught middle school mathematics, I do think sometimes teachers assign entirely too many problems. If it takes you 5 minutes to get through a math problem in your regular class as you're going through it with the class and talking through the problem and here we're going to put our X's together and blah, blah, blah. If it takes you 5 minutes in class, then it's going to take them 5 minutes or more at home on their own to think through it or whatever at the beginning, you know, when they're not super savvy on the skill. And so I would always try to assign like, four problems. Sometimes that practice can happen right there in class.
That's true.
When your teacher can help you, because what happens with middle school mathematics, and for me, it's language.
Sorry, son,
you know,
I can't help
like
you.
They can't help them. So then they're just frustrated at home, and there's nothing good that comes from that.
Right. I'm like, call your mom.
Okay, that's at the elementary school level, right? So at the high school, there is some research, and there does seem to be a correlation between homework and standardized test scores. But the correlation is pretty weak, and they, in fact, found a prominent researcher who did find a solid correlation, but they returned a little later only to discover that the homework had no effect after all. So they redid the study and found that it really didn't make a big difference. But the areas, it's funny you should say, the areas in which it does make a difference in high school is math and science.
Okay.
So they found that math and science, there were some correlations to find. There was a positive effect in some studies, but in other subjects, it was really just kind of busy work, right?
I do think that the homework thing has gotten way out of hand, and I know lots of teachers that feel the same way, but they feel backed up against a wall because of all the pressure of, drum roll, Standardized testing.
And so yeah, it's exactly.
Like they feel like, oh, but I don't want my kids to suffer. I don't want myself to suffer because, you know, we're just going to put as much as we can into it as possible. But really what you really have is your higher achieving students are the ones that are actually doing the homework and they probably don't need to. And then your lower achieving students probably aren't, you know, even doing the homework. They have some reason or another. And even when they try, they're just frustrated. So it's
I think what you're describing is causation versus coincidence, right? So, like, probably my kids that are going to do well on that statewide assessment are probably doing their homework anyway, right? And so there's probably some correlation. But if you also think about coming from having a career in education measurement, we do a lot of work with large-scale assessments. Like, it's really, really hard. Like, there's a reason why this study says it doesn't help state test scores or standardized test scores. And that's because you can't really study for those tests because they're gauging mastery and synthesis, right? And if you don't have mastery and synthesis, and so for the folks out there in radio land, I guess, or pod land, I guess, you know, mastery and synthesis is if you give the same concept to a child, forwards and backwards, matching, find it, pick it out, you know, any one of 20 ways that you can give a question to a child or assess something for a child, they get it almost every single time. That's mastery and synthesis. It's not just you can pick it out of A, B, C, D, but you can fill in the blank, you can match, you can do all these other styles of assessment. They can write an essay about it. That's mastery and synthesis. And if you think about it, there's really not homework that you can give someone that's going to help them with mastery and synthesis. Mastery and synthesis usually is obtained through direct instruction.
But it sounds like to me, and Lissa, you chime in here, it would probably take a brave superintendent or principal to be like, no more homework, quit doing that, to take that burden, that stress.
Well, we actually had that on our podcast.
Yeah,
was it Florida? I feel like it's Florida.
Yeah, we need to try to get them on.
And remember you said, I'm going to check with them in a year and see, you know, did you have a drop or, you know.
Right.
But I bet you morale is way, way up.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I think whenever, and kind of closing, getting back to what I was talking about the, you know, state legislators, you know, filing bills for this sort of thing, everybody thinks back to their high school and their elementary education. They think, what a great day that was. You know, like, I wish kids could learn like that. You're learning things 3 and 4 years behind what kids are learning today, right? School is different. And so we can't just assume that daily homework assignments, because I had daily homework assignments and now I'm some legislator in a state, that that's a great thing, right? Like, look at me. I did that. Now I'm I'm doing well too. Maybe it had nothing to do with your homework. Maybe it had a lot to do with the teachers that you had and 100 other things, right?
Right.
But maybe we shouldn't. This is like the thing that drives me crazy about people are always talking about how well schools perform, but they never talk about the administrative burden that's placed upon them. Largely, people talk about the feds, but really a lot of legislation comes down from the state level.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
And I know it's a real challenge for a company like yours, Russ, because you guys do assessments, and it's as if the state legislators can't even figure out what the assessments are. Like, they're changing.
That's right. Yeah, to be clear, we don't actually administer assessments, but we do take in the data from assessments. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, we work in 8 states. And because of everything that's happened with Common Core and PARC and all these different assessments, we've changed assessments in several states once a year on some level for the past 5 years easily. And so I don't think it's horrible. I mean, it's hard on us. It really is. But it's really hard on teachers, right? Like, how do you expect these people to know this content and materials whenever you change the assessment almost every year, and then you change the way schools are graded every year? Don't get me started. Yeah. We could talk an hour for this.
Well, I know superintendents lean heavily on you guys to be like, what does this mean for us? Like, they look to you
absolutely.
To help, you know, decipher all that.
Yeah, and we help interpret it as best we can. Often we are left in the position of having to divine it, right? Like, it's not clearly spelled out in either the law or the state departments of education. Don't do a good job of putting out guidance. And so it's really just kind of a guess about, yeah, I think they'll interpret it this way. And you really never know until grades or whatever are sitting there in front of them, and you'll know actually how they came down on it. So yeah, it's tough.
Well, I've got one that was a pretty big challenge for a school district recently. But I kind of have to applaud the students on this one. Have you heard about these students? This is in Utah. They had a teacher that was just disappeared, and they had a student newspaper, and they wanted some more information about why the teacher disappeared, and they couldn't get anything. So over about a month and a half, they started filling out public records requests and to get certain documents.
Wow.
Yeah. And it turned out what they found was that the high school teacher had been fired for misconduct. And so they started reporting that, and they were actually putting this on the school's website, like it's the school paper website. And they said typically they would get about 10 page views in a day. They put that story on, shot up to about 800.
Well,
wow. But then it gets more interesting, because the day goes by and it's shut down and the admin access and everything, and they pulled the article off. And this is what kind of irks me a little bit, you know, just having the journalist background. You know, these students did something that 99 out of 100 applicants that came into my newsroom didn't know how to do. When you come out of college, a lot of kids with journalism backgrounds don't know how to do public records requests properly. And these kids went through the process of doing it. I'm under the impression that they had someone coaching them, somebody with a journalism background, a parent
sure.
or somebody, you know, because it's not that easy. And then you hit roadblocks and you have to learn how to work around the roadblocks. But you got to applaud the kids, because once they pulled the website down, then they said, well, you know what, we'll go create our own website.
Right, because that's news. And
yeah,
so.
And so they did, and they put the story back up and got more views on it. Now, I do kind of feel a little guilty, because I also believe that personnel issues are personnel issues, and only so much information should be let out about a teacher and so forth. But you should follow the rule of the law, and if something's public information, it should be released.
Okay, so I mean, I want to know, I mean, you may not tell me, but like, was she wrongfully dismissed? Like, was she...
It doesn't seem like it. It seems like she did something wrong and they fired her. But and there's only so much, it varies from state to state, but there's only so much information they have to give, especially
right.
when it comes to personnel issues. But I guess they admitted to some sort of misconduct.
Malfeasance or
yeah.
misconduct, yeah.
And it'll probably be left at
alleged.
That. Yeah, exactly. And so we'll probably never know more than that. But they got the information. And then what's even funnier is once they published the information, local media followed suit, mm-hmm. confirmed the information, and
they
ran
the
stories themselves. Yeah.
yeah,
they got scooped.
Like, thanks
by
for the
work. So what a lesson in journalism that they just had, even though it was at, you know, kind of made the school district look bad.
It really does sound like a John Green novel.
the school district, I mean, I think that they certainly have a right to pull down content that is created using their resources.
True.
But I do think that this is one of those things where it sounds like a good idea at the time, but the optics are pretty bad, right?
No doubt.
Like, this is just, it's a PR issue, right? You may have done what you felt was right at the time, but I don't think they were, I don't think their PIO kind of thought this through, or whomever, you know, decided to make that call.
Right.
Because, you know, what's more of a story, this person being dismissed, which happens very often. School districts are complex places and people get dismissed, people get fired, or people leave. But what do you think's more of a story? That, which is a story for 10 minutes, mm-hmm. or the story that we are suppressing the information, censoring it, and now these kids have created their own website, which I think is a testament to, like, the kids, but also the world that we live in, where information will not be suppressed.
I found the story in the Washington Post. This wasn't a local Utah paper, so Russ is right. It's that censorship that brought this story to a whole new level.
It's called the Barbara Streisand effect. Those of you who want to look that up.
What's the story behind that?
So Barbara Streisand sued. They were taking coastal erosion pictures and pictures of the cliffs of California, which are public domain in California. Like, the beaches belong to the public. And Barbara Streisand sued because they took pictures of her mansion. And so in the process of, nobody would have ever really looked at coastal erosion pictures, right? But because she sued, it made it a big deal. And then all of a sudden, the pictures of her house were published in every newspaper in the country,
right?
Because she made a big deal of it. They said, well, let's just publish that picture and let's see what they're talking about here. And it showed this really lavish mansion. And I'm sure she wanted her privacy, but don't build on the coast of California if you want your privacy. And also, by the way, the skies belong to everyone. But it's called the Barbara Streisand effect for that very reason.
There you go.
That things that you want quiet, it's often, once they're out, you can't really do a whole lot about it. And the bigger deal you make of it only exponentially makes it worse.
That's right.
We see this happen a lot, no doubt. Well, are you guys ready for the bright idea?
Yeah.
Yes.
We are talking to a gentleman out of the California area, Los Angeles area. His name's Robert Ward. And he is going to talk to us about enduring the education pendulum. And what I mean by this, and this is actually a blog, that's the title he put on the blog that he wrote. It's a little bit counter to what we talk about. We throw out a lot of ideas every episode. We throw out, you know, there's gamification and you've got makerspaces and
flipped classrooms.
You know, what's right, what's wrong? Should you have knee-jerk reactions to these new ideas and how you kind of survive through a long career in education and try to decipher which ones you pick up?
Right. And, you know, your interview that you had on episode 35 in the little pop quiz at the end, that's what she said, was there's so much stuff that's new and cutting edge and current, it's hard to know what to go after and what not to as a teacher.
Stay tuned. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is a teacher, author, and founder of the Rewarding Education blog. For more than two decades, Robert Ward has taught English at middle schools in the Los Angeles area, and he authored four books, including A Teacher's Inside Advice to Parents. And his newest offering is Talented Teachers, Empowering Parents, Successful Students, Classroom Strategies for Including All Families in Education. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
I want to learn a lot about your newest book in a minute, but before we get there, I want to talk about a blog post I read that you wrote on rewardingeducation.com, and it really caught my eye, and it was entitled Enduring the Education Pendulum, and the way I interpreted it was, with all these ideas that are thrown out there about education, take it in stride, use moderation. Did I interpret that right?
Yes, because this is my 25th year in the classroom. And if I don't take things in stride and take it in moderation, there are going to be problems.
And so that's why I really wanted to have you on the show, because every week we're throwing out ideas, you know, the flipped classroom or, you know, maker spaces. I could go on and on, digital portfolios. And I guess you've kind of seen a lot of these ideas come and go. What were you trying to tell other educators with this blog?
My main message, and it's probably the main message that goes through all of my writing, is that there needs to be balance in education. And I would even, you know, transfer that into the home, where parenting needs to be a balance. So I mostly write about attending to the needs of the whole child, which to me is four main components for fundamental necessities of children. Their social needs, their emotional needs, their soulful needs, and their intellectual needs.
If you're an educator, you're new, or you know, in the first 5 years or so, how do you distinguish with what you should grip onto and when it comes to new ideas in teaching? What's your advice for younger teachers?
Well, it's hard. And so I have the long view of 25 years. So, you know, this educational pendulum, it's a real thing. There is, you know, the latest hot new thing. And especially as connected as I am on Twitter, you know, I get all the latest buzzes and buzzwords and new techniques. And so, you know, sometimes it'll be people saying it's all about dot, dot, dot. So the probably the most prevalent thing right now is it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. And relationships are very important. That emotional connection between a teacher and a parent, or a parent and their child, is really important. But it's not just about relationships.
What is it, in your opinion? Where are we?
Well, right now? It's about four things. So when I first started teaching, and I was brand new and green as all heck, and the kids, you know, ate me alive. Mm-hmm. To me, the magic bullet of teaching was classroom management. I just needed to be able to manage those kids and all my problems would be solved. And when I did get a handle on my classroom and I was extremely firm, I was surprised to notice that, well, yes, my kids would sit down and do what I said, but they weren't engaged. We didn't have a strong teacher-parent relationship, a teacher-child-student relationship, and that needed to change. So I needed to add other elements. It wasn't just about management. It wasn't just about instruction. It was about that engagement factor and kids being interested and having a voice and choice. And it was about having a relationship where you could be empathetic with your kids. You could be friendly with your kids. It wasn't about don't smile until Christmas. But back right. in the 90s, when I first started teaching, that aphorism was still big time. Don't smile before Christmas. You're a new teacher. Don't smile before Christmas.
When you speak of this education pendulum swinging back and forth, what do you see right now? And this is just one person's opinion, but I'm really curious. What do you see right now that you feel like this is such a fad?
See, the thing is, in my writing, I like to take polarizing issues and rationally explain how it really shouldn't be polarizing at all. It doesn't have to be tech or not tech. There can be a balance. It doesn't have to be whole language or phonics. There can be a balance. So I like to, instead of arguing against something else, I like to bring out the best of both sides mm-hmm. and come up with a viable solution.
I think that's a pretty diplomatic way to look at it. And, you know, again, that moderation approach is probably key. We were talking about that pendulum swinging back and forth. In your time as a teacher, when have you seen it swing and it hit the mark? It was right in the past two decades. Has anything ever been just, you know, this is a huge step forward in education in your mind?
Nick, that's a really good question.
Thank you.
Have I ever seen them get it right?
Right.
Not often. Not often, my friend. No, it's usually one extreme or the other. So to me, the best thing that school districts and administrators can do is directly support teachers, not dictate to them or direct them to death. There needs to be a balance. There needs to be certain norms and standards that teachers follow. But teachers need a great deal of autonomy and support, you know, if they're starting out and they're new.
Switching gears a little bit, your latest book is called Talented Teachers, Empowered Parents, Successful Students. It was just released last week, correct?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
So it was born, the previous book I wrote was called A Teacher's Inside Advice to Parents, How Children Thrive with Leadership, Love, Laughter, and Learning. Mm-hmm. And again, that's my four whole child components. The leadership is, you know, having rules and boundaries and structures for kids. The love is that emotional bonding component. The laughter is that engagement and passion and drive and really trying to awaken, you know, a sense of purpose in kids. And then, of course, the learning was that, you know, teachers and parents are both responsible for learning for kids. So that book was devoted to parents. And so this book is written explicitly for educators. And on the title, I have teachers, parents, and students, because that triad is really important. And I think, I'm not going to say the last big divide or big frontier in education, but it is certainly something that we really, really haven't gotten a handle on. Getting parents truly involved. As I explained in the book, your biggest calling card to parents as a teacher is just being a darn good teacher. That your students are really learning and progressing and achieving, that your students are really involved and engaged and like your class, that they feel a sense of belonging in your class and that you truly care about them as an individual, and that you have a well-managed class and that kids are respectful and cooperative and courteous. So when kids are coming home and talking about Mr. Ward's class or Miss So-and-so's class or Mr. So-and-so's class, that is the best thing you can do when they are saying something positive to their parents. And oftentimes it's not the parent asking the kid, it's the kid talking about, you know, this cool class that they have. And that's the first thing that I think teachers need to know, that you've got to be a really excellent teacher attending to the needs of the whole child. And I explained tons of strategies in the book. I take it section by section that you've got to be just a darn good teacher. Then I go into different ways that you can also engage parents, letting parents know what's going on in your classroom with an easy to implement weekly newsletter. And again, that newsletter focusing on, you know, classroom management things, exciting things in your classroom, different activities that the kids are engaged in, and then touting the successes that your students are having. If you can keep your parents up to date just once a week with a weekly newsletter or whatever app that you use to connect with your parents, that goes a long way. And that's just one of the tips in my book.
What would you say, and I've always been curious about this as a parent with kids, what would you say to teachers who are sending out those updates and they're getting little feedback? How common is that? You know, the parents are probably reading it, but they aren't always necessarily letting you know.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Teachers are overwhelmed, parents are overwhelmed. So let's be honest. Some teachers think the best parent relationship I have is parents who I have no contact with. They don't bother me, I don't bother them. And vice versa for the parents. I don't want the teacher always constantly having, you know, I have to sign this reading log, or I have to do this, or I have to be involved in this project. So it is a balance because parents and teachers are both busy. But we have a commitment to each other. And if there's a sense of true welcome, a true belonging, a true cohesion and partnership between parents and teachers, parents are willing to do their part. And so it might be things like I have a homework assignment with my students called dinner table discussions, where we just take either teacher-generated or student-generated questions and just a couple broad questions that are related to what we're learning in the class at the time. And they just go home once a week and they ask their parents and their siblings questions, and then they report back. And that's a way that the parents are engaged. They're talking about different issues. So whatever it happens to be, if we're reading a book that takes place during the civil rights movement and you're asking your parents about, you know, what were they doing during the civil rights movement? How did it affect them? That's a way that parents are apprised of what's going on in the class, and they feel like they're kind of contributing.
Mm-hmm. I understand in your book, you use the phrase move parents from involvement to investment. And that's a high bar. I think a lot of teachers, educators would be just satisfied with involvement. But why is it so important to get that investment?
Well, if you get that investment, you just get so much more. Because what I like to say is there needs to be a seamless transition between the classroom and the family room. That if some of the same things are going on that in the home and in the classroom, kids then have this sense of cohesion. They have this sense that, you know what, wherever I am, I'm courteous and respectful and cooperative, that there are, you know, rules and routines and procedures at home. There are rules and routines and procedures at class. That's not something different. And so when you have that seamless bridge, it really makes parents be an equal partner in their child's education. And parents want that. They just often don't know how to do it. And they want it done in a way where it's not taking too much of their time.
The book is Talented Teachers, Empowered Parents, and Successful Students, Classroom Strategies for Including All Families in Education. If someone wants to find the book, how do they find it?
They can find it on Amazon, and it is affordably priced. So the ebook is just $3.99 and the paperback is $14.95. I priced it so that teachers on a budget could actually buy this book, use this book, keep it on their desk, and find tons of tips and strategies so that they can strengthen the teacher-parent bond.
Great stuff. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Oh, all right. It truly is a pop quiz. I didn't know I was being quizzed, so okay.
Right. Yeah, I know. We like to catch people off guard. First question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
One. Well, I'm biased because I'm an English teacher, but I would have to say reading. And I would have to say reading for pleasure and reading for wisdom. I think that's a really, really important quality that goes out to all the content areas. It supports all the content areas.
Next question. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
We're not teaching teachers to attend to the needs of the whole child. You do not hear the term whole child that often. And when you hear it, it's mostly about social emotional, which is great, and I'm all for social emotional, but I add that soulful component also, that teachers are teaching with passion and enthusiasm, and kids are really engaged and have a voice in their classroom.
What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves belonging, a sense of belonging, a sense of place. Welcome, inclusion, acceptance goes a long way.
What do you think the biggest challenge is for today's educators?
I think the biggest challenge is dealing with parents these days. I think that even veteran teachers who have long prided themselves with excellent relationships with parents are now finding parents. See, 10, 15, 20 years ago, parents were pretty much on board with teachers, that teachers and parents expected the same things. Now, because of the educational pendulum, and not really in a bad way, there is so much out there. There has been so much experimentation. And experimentation and innovation is a good thing. But you have parents who want a lot of homework. And then you have just as many parents who don't want really hardly any or no homework. So you have all these different things that parents are expecting. Some want, you know, very, very rigorous instruction. Some want more project-based and blended learning and technology. So it's hard to please those parents. So reaching out to parents, I think, is a huge, huge necessity today in education.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Oh, I think the best gift for me and that I'd like to see for everybody is an experienced, empathetic mentor. If you can have a mentor, someone at the beginning of your career, middle and end, teachers want to learn. And if you can have somebody who's willing to help out and listen, that's huge.
Which teacher changed your life?
Oh,
We always stump people there. Yeah, you can if you really.
I'm picking two because they were married. So it was my 11th grade honors English teacher, Ms. Doy, mm-hmm. who was married to my 12th grade honors English teacher, Mr. Litton. They were fantastic teachers, and we read so many fantastic books, and it was two wonderful, memorable years in my education.
Sounds like quite the power couple there.
Yeah, yeah.
Last question, pen or pencil?
Okay, I'm going to fudge it. I'm going to say mechanical pencil.
I like those too, yeah.
You know, it's always sharp. It is so noticeable that the kid's writing is so much neater with a mechanical pencil, and then they still have the option of erasing.
36 episodes, you're the first person to say mechanical pencil, but I applaud you for that. So.
All right,
good stuff. Robert Ward, again, we appreciate your time. The blog is rewardingeducation.com. I have that right, correct?
Yes, sir.
And again, you can check out his books over at Amazon.com. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Nick. It was a pleasure.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.